This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Here's the thing. We're all going to die. Nobody lives forever. Dr. Norton Hadler likes to put it this way. The human body has an end date. He reminds us that believing that we're going to live much beyond the age of 85 is mostly wishful thinking. But in his latest book, Dr. Hadler warns that the healthcare industry wants to convince you otherwise. Hadler says they've medicalized old age and it's affecting our pocketbooks and our quality of life. Norton Hadler is a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is called Rethinking Aging, Growing Old and Living Well in an Overtreated Society. And he joins us now in the studio to talk about it. Welcome back.
It's a pleasure, Frank. Good to see you again.
So why did you write this book?
A number of reasons. One is it's actually a celebratory book. My generation, which the economists call the traditionalists, and the boomers, who are right behind my generation, are the first birth cohort in the history of the world that can arrive at age 60 or so and seriously and rationally wonder, what am I going to do with the next 20 to 25 years? It's a remarkable evolution in longevity, and it's happened relatively quickly. It's happened right after World War II and escalated at the end of the 20th century, and it's caught society somewhat blindsided. It is true we will die. It would not be reasonable to arrive at age 60 and wonder what I'm going to do with the next 30 years. But with the next 25 years, that's a reasonable bit of wondering. And it's a time when these generations actually have a fair amount of wherewithal to make decisions. That's also new. And I took a look at the way we are responding to this wonderful happenstance. And we're responding by wondering, what sort of minefield do we have for the next 25 years? And I'm a medical educator, and as you know, I've thought this through in many other contexts, but this is a crucial context, the context of life after 60. And I thought it was time for an educational event. What this book is written to do is to teach the readership how to ask questions about all the advice they're going to receive so that they make decisions that are fully informed or at least as informed as contemporary science allows. And so the book does two things. It informs the reader as and making decisions related to their own health, and it celebrates the fact that if they are informed decision makers, they should enjoy 20, 25 more years
and you
when
say
they hit 60.
Part of what we're dealing with here is that we have medicalized old age.
We've medicalized a lot of life. Some of my earlier books talk about the medicalization of life before age 60. I actually have problems with the word, the concept of old age. This is another stage of life, and it is an advantage stage of life. It has some challenges. It has some predictability to it, but so do other stages of life. And there's no reason to decide that because you're now over age 60, you are a medical minefield. There are changes that will come with each passing year. Most of which are not that limiting, some of which are limiting, and there are ways to think them through, just like there would be ways to think them through in earlier times in life.
But some of these are very scary changes. If you're a man over 60, you better get that PSA test because prostate cancer is a good chance. There's a good chance.
One of the chapters talks about, called a chapter called Staying Alive, and takes us through the notion of screening. And that's what a PSA is. It's a screening test. And which, by the way, is very different from a diagnostic test, although they may be exactly the same thing. A diagnostic test is when you have a question. There's something that's bothering you. When you go to your physician and you say, this is bothering me, and the physician orders whatever test the physician can explain to you would be a reasonable thing to do to deal with what is bothering you. That's a diagnostic test. A test like the PSA is not a diagnostic test. It's a screening test. There's no symptom that's driving you to have a PSA except they told you you ought to have it. And you never, ever want to submit to a screening test unless the test is accurate, the disease is important, and we can do something about it that's meaningful to you. So in response to your hypothetical. If you're over a man over age 60 doesn't need a PSA to find out if they have cancer of the prostate. By the time they're 70, essentially every man has cancer of the prostate. So it's a very different question you're asking with the PSA. You're asking, I have cancer of the prostate. Can you tell me with the PSA whether I will die with this cancer of the prostate or I will die from this cancer of the prostate? And what I do in the book is take you through the data, because there is a rich and compelling data set, so that you can interface with this decision, because every man over age 60, and if some groups have their way, every man is going to be asked to submit to a PSA. By the way, I won't let anybody check my PSA.
So this means if you have, you're saying that we all at a certain point, all of us men, will have cancer of the prostate, but it may move so slowly that something else is going to get us, that we're going to survive it, and that the treatment, which is removing the prostate, may not be the smart thing to do, even if we find out that we've got cancer.
If I had a test that could determine that you, in fact, have a prostate cancer that's going to be the cause of your death before your time, then by all means, have that test. Unfortunately, we don't have that test. We also have a procedure that will take away your risk of dying from cancer, not entirely, but close to entirely. However, it is either a radiation therapy treatment or a surgical treatment, both of which have substantial side effects that are obligate. So you have to say to yourself, here I am wanting to reduce the chance that not that I will die, but that I will die before my time from this cause, from prostate cancer. And I'm willing to go to great lengths to make sure that doesn't happen. Such great lengths that I will tolerate the notion that I might end up incontinent. A conservative estimate is about 15% of the men who have some sort of major procedure to protect them from death from prostate cancer end up incontinent, and none of them are happy about that. About 30% end up with impotence, and about half of them are unhappy with that and need to take pills to deal with that. So if you're informed about the risks and benefits and the trade-offs, and the fact that we have studies that say the PSA doesn't really pick up who's at most risk of dying before their time, and you're still willing to have the possibility of incontinence, fine.
But at this point, that's all we can say, is that we don't really have any way of telling you whether this is going to extend your life. There is nothing out there. There's no other way that I can evaluate the potential. I mean, is there not a more aggressive? Can I not have a biopsy done once I have the screening test, and the biopsy would show an either a more or less aggressive kind of cancer?
It sounds good, and there is such an approach. In fact, that is the common approach. If your PSA goes up, you get a biopsy. And the biopsy goes under the microscope, and pathologists look at it and say, gee, this looks like cancer, and then they grade it on how ugly the cells look. The trouble is that only at the extreme is the grading particularly predictive, and the extreme grading is quite rare. So there are an awful lot of people who have had prostate biopsies and then have to go to sleep at night saying, gee whiz, I have prostate cancer. It wasn't the most extreme type, but here I am with prostate cancer. And that's a very difficult way to sleep through the night.
Well, that's, I think, a big part of your book as well, the fact that you present this very rationally, but you understand that when we're talking about my illness and my screening, all bets are off.
Well, it's important that we discuss that before the biopsy, in fact, before the PSA, which is what this book teaches. That you should not come to this discussion after you've had your biopsy. You should come to this discussion before you have your PSA. What if? What will I do in this event? What will I do in that event? And it's relatively easy to show that we change men with a diagnosis of prostate cancer, even if we tell them it doesn't look like it's an evil form. We change your self-image. We do that with lots of things that we do. Cholesterol screening. It's easy to show that once we tell you that you have a high cholesterol, you no longer think of yourself as entirely well. You think of yourself as a problem waiting to happen, for which you have to try to do something, whether it's with a pill or with some sort of intervention, which is why this country is medicalized to be so prone to swallow pills and interventions, despite the fact that we are loaded with information that they're not advantaged by either.
Well, this gets to this remarkable cultural feature of American life, our denial of death, whether you want to admit that or not, and our sense that death is an impulse, insult. I think you used the story by Guy de Maupassant to illustrate, I think, pretty well where we are on the spectrum.
There was a time when death was uniformly a tragedy. And it's not that long ago when all people knew a neighbor who died at age 40 of a heart attack. We're now having a very different time. We have a time when you arrive at age 60 and the vast majority of the population will, and a goodly percentage, the vast majority, will arrive at 70, and an awful lot of us will arrive at 80. That's a very different frame of reference for don't go quietly into the great unknown. Don't go quietly into the great unknown can cost you an awful lot of grief for 20, 25 years before you will go into the great unknown, because the death rate remains one per person. We're just changing the longevity. So, yeah, we talked, the last several chapters were difficult to write. There's a lot of my soul in this book, trying to reflect on just these notions. I mean, no, I don't think death is a wonderful notion, but I think a ripe old age is a wonderful notion. I don't think coping with insults and challenges is wonderful, but I think coping effectively and gracefully is appropriate rather than thrashing about for everything that is offered. And boy, are there a lot of things offered, most of which have scientific documentation saying that their effectiveness is either nil or minimal.
Well, I think and spinal pain is a pretty good example of that. Maybe you can tell us about the research and how that corresponds with how people respond to the diagnosis.
The book just before this one was called Stabbed in the Back, and that was a working age book, and I took a look at the social construction of backache in our society. There is a chapter in Rethinking Aging, which I titled Decrepitude, and I look at some of the musculoskeletal challenges that are ubiquitous after age 60 and some of the labeling that everybody is faced with and some of the options in therapeutic intervention. Is there such a thing as spinal stenosis? And what do we do about spinal stenosis? And the answer is, yes, there is, but it's exceedingly rare because it is not an anatomical diagnosis. It has nothing to do with what your back looks like on x-rays or MRI. It has to do with a very special kind of symptom. And the reason that's true is backs on MRI that look like the canal is encroached upon are normal at age 70. I mean, the last time anyone who's listening had a high likelihood of a perfectly pristine spine was age 14. We're talking about graying of the spine. And our ability to look at any image and say that's the cause of your symptom is exceedingly low. So most of the people who are being operated on for what is called spinal stenosis have back pain and x-rays that are dramatic, but don't have the syndrome of spinal stenosis, which is probably best managed medically, particularly when we look at the Medicare data on the complication rate of the surgery for spinal, so-called spinal stenosis, and the complication rate is enormous. The indication varies from region to region. And the yield in terms of, thank you, doctor, I feel much better, is well under 30% nationally. So it's another time for informed medical decision-making and another time for teaching people how to ask, what do you mean by spinal stenosis and why are you offering me these procedures? What data do you have that suggests that I will be benefited?
And the book very much centers on that very question, on whether or not we're well enough informed and how to ask the right questions. Personally, from a public policy point of view, what are the implications of this book and your findings?
Well, I didn't write it for that to that end, at least not directly. In fact, this is the fourth of the five books I've decided to write for the general audience. Most of my career prior to 10 years ago was writing for my guild. These are different exercises. They're educational exercises. And these four are entirely designed for informed medical decision-making. I do mention dollars occasionally, and I do mention numbers of people who are labeled or treated or operated on, but I don't emphasize that. I will in the book that I just finished, which will come out after the election. That's what my publisher prefers, and they've talked me into that. I think they're right. If you ask simple questions like, if I look at what's done commonly in America for which the science says the evidence for efficacy is illusory, these have been studied and we can't show you're benefited, yet we still do them. If you lump those together with the exorbitant and unconscionable administrative overhead of this thing we call the healthcare delivery system, you can drop this other interesting notion, the healthcare dollar, by about 60%. So the implications for policy are enormous. I write and speak a good deal about what I call the efficacy agenda, as opposed to the what we all hear about, which is quality. If we could do it better and cheaper and paper-free, everybody would be fine. Well, I say no. If it doesn't work, I don't care how well you do it, don't do it. If that was the horse and not the cart, we would have a very different healthcare system.
Dr. Norton Hadler, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Dr. Morton Hadler is a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The new book, Rethinking Aging, Growing Old and Living Well in an Overtreated Society, going to be at Flyleaf Books, 7 o'clock, September 14th. Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. That's the state of things for today. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.